Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. But just let it be. Na, 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, girl. Just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long for their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. Let it be.
That's right, the world will not get any better if we just let it be. We got to do this thing together. We'd like to welcome everyone to MPH Radio. Today is May the 9th, 2020. Our theme for today, we'll be dealing with a very special place that has a very special meaning to Africa and African people, and that thing entails race in Cuba, getting an understanding. And we're going to have our keynote presenter who will present some very interesting information on that theme with you later on during this podcast. But like always, we'd like to welcome you to MPH Radio, and we'd like to remind you that the agenda for today's program will entail the whole issue of what is freedom, getting you something to think about. What is freedom? Then we'll follow our Black Media Packs with Susie. Then we'll come in with our keynote speaker today, presenter, who's going to deal with today's theme, which is, again, is race in Cuba, getting a better understanding. Brother Otis Cunningham. Like always, we will encourage you to come and join in with us by dialing 818-337-0016. So right now, let's come into our underserved communities with the message of the day as relates to the theme for this particular segment of the program, giving you something to think about. What is freedom? Once you get your pen and piece of paper and take these different concepts of freedom. You know, we often talk about the concept of freedom. Many people have died for this concept. So what we want to do is give you something to think about and try to get a better understanding of what do people mean or what does history say what freedom is. So here's some definition we took from some of the individuals who define what freedom means to them. The first concept of freedom we have comes from Abraham Lincoln, where he stated that man is good enough, no man is good enough to govern another man without his consent. Let me repeat that. No man is good enough to govern another man without his consent. What do you think about that? Let's go to the second concept of freedom by Nelson Mandela. He stated, when a man is denied the right to live the life he believes in, he has no choice but become an outlaw. Let me repeat that again. When a man is denied the right to live the life he believes in, he has no choice but to become an outlaw. And the last thought for today for this segment, as it deals with what is freedom, we're going to come with the definition or the concept by Alice Walker, who stated, no person is your friend who demands your silence or denies your right to grow. Let me repeat that one again. No person is your friend who demands your silence or denies your right to grow. What do y'all think about these concepts and how does it fit into your reality as you continue struggling for this concept we call freedom? So what we're going to do right now, just give you something to think about. What we're going to do right now, we're going to pause for the call, take a station break, and when we come back, get your pen and paper out, we're going to have Susie, who will give you some black mini facts for today's program. So right now, we're going to pause for this call. We'll be right back, and you are listening to MPH Radio.
Tennessee.
Lord, I've really been real stressed, down and out, losing ground. Although I am black and brown, problems got me pessimistic. Brothers and sisters keep messing up. Why does it have to be so damn tough? I don't know where I can go to let these ghosts out of my skull. My grandma passed, my brother's gone. I never at once felt so alone. I know you're supposed to be my steering wheel, not just my spare tire. But Lord, I ask you to be my guiding force of truth. For some strange reason it had to be. He guided me to Tennessee. Over me. We talk to each other in a friendship way. Then out of nowhere, you tell me to break out of the country and into more country. Fast eyes burst into rhythm. Where the ghosts are shouted on me. Walk the road my forefathers walk. Climb the trees my forefathers hung from. Ask those trees for all their wisdom. They tell me my ears are so young. Go back to whence you came. My family tree, my family name. For some strange reason it had to be. He guided me to Tennessee.
Down to Holly Springs. Razadon and Baba, they went down to Peace Street. Headliner, I challenge you to a game of horseshoes. A game of horseshoes!
Now I see the importance of history. While my people be in the mess that they be. Many journeys to freedom made in vain. My brothers on the corner playing ghetto games. I ask you, Lord, why you enlighten me? Without the enlightenment of all my folks. He said, cause I set myself on a quest for truth. And he was there to quench my thirst. But I am still thirsty.
We'd like to welcome you back to MPH. We will continue down the road of our family tree. We're in the context of learning the contributions that African people have made to the world, and we can do this by presenting our black mini facts for today's program. And we will now bring in our contributor and member, Susie. She will present some black mini facts for today's program. Susie, welcome to MPH Radio.
Good evening, everyone. For today's Black History Facts, we're going to deal with education. And education, if you can't read, It's going to be hard to realize dreams, and that was stated by Booker T. Washington. For African Americans, achieving equality in education has been an uphill struggle. These educators who I present to you today, which are pioneers, share a passion for hard work and, like many others, face prejudice and other obstacles as they work to bring fairness in education to African Americans everywhere. The first individual I'd like to tell you about is Alan Locke, 1886 to 1954. Alan Locke's career as a teacher began in 1912 and continued for 41 years. Prior to beginning his career in teaching at Howard University, Locke was named a Rhodes Scholar in 1907 and attended Hertford College, Oxford University, from 1907 to 1910. In addition to his dedication to education and teaching, Locke was the architect of the Harlem Renaissance, which focused on promoting African American culture and art. Locke not only influenced young writers with original and somewhat controversial philosophical writings, but also instilled an appreciation for the arts in his pupils. That's a brief history on Alan Locke. The next one is Booker T. Washington, 1856 to 1915, was a dominant figure in African American society in the latter part of the 19th century. Among Washington's many accomplishments is his leadership of the Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute, founded in 1881. Washington's goal was to teach his students both trades and academics so that they could become teachers in emerging schools and colleges for African Americans across the South. And the last and final Black history for today is for John Dickey, 1806 to 1878, and his wife, Sarah Cresson, founded Ashmun Institute in 1854, later renamed Lincoln University in honor of Abraham Lincoln. The college was the first degree-granting university for African American and attracted talented students from across the country. These resources come from the African American Heritage 2017 calendar, and that's just a few of our Africans that made progress among our people.
Okay, let me say, in the field of education, right now what we're going to do is make another quick station break, and when we come back, we will have Brother Otis Cunningham, who will address our theme today, Race in Cuba, getting a better understanding. You are listening to Missing Pages of History.
If I
welcome back to MPH Radio. And at this point in time, what we're going to do is we're going to entertain our theme today, which is race in Cuba, getting a better understanding. You know, many times when we hear the word Cuba, all kind of strange thoughts comes into our minds. We're going to try to change that a little bit today. We're going to try to fill in this missing pages of history as it relates to how people view Cuba and its contribution to humanity. And our subject today is race in Cuba, getting an understanding. And to do that, we have invited Otis Cunningham. He can come and give his perspective on this issue. And right now, we'd like to welcome Otis to MPH Radio. And Brother Otis, will you introduce yourself and share with our listening audience a little something about who you are?
Okay, all right. Yeah, good afternoon. You know, I'm African American. I'm like 71 years old. I was born in 1949. So when the Cuban Revolution triumphed, when Fidel Castro's government came to power in January of 1959, I was only 10 years old. So I don't really remember that that struggle, but I do remember in 1962 what was called the Cuban Missile Crisis. Because in 1961, 1 year after, or 2 years after the revolution came to power, the United States sponsored an invasion of Cuba by 1,000-plus Cuban exiles to overthrow the Cuban Revolution. And at that point, Cuba turned to the Soviet Union for support. The Soviet Union installed some missiles, some defensive missiles, ballistic missiles in Cuba to protect the Cuban Revolution as a shield. The United States had a naval blockade, and I remember as a child, I was about 12 in 1962. I remember we would have air raid drills. We would have to go underneath our desks. I remember anti-aircraft missiles on the Chicago lakefront that you could see. And that was the beginning of my interest, I would say, in Cuba. When I graduated from high school in the late 1960s, I became involved. I went to college. I became involved in supporting African liberation movements that were struggling against Portuguese colonialism or white minority rule in Africa. And I first learned about the Cuban Revolution through working with African liberation movements in Guinea-Bissau, Angola, Mozambique, Namibia, Zimbabwe, and South Africa. And they told us, those of us that were working in support of their causes, they told us that the Cubans provided all kind of material support and educational support for their efforts to fight colonialism and white minority rule. So long before I ever went to Cuba, in the 1970s, I heard about Cuba and its role in supporting the Pan-African struggle. So that was my first interest. And then I went to Cuba for the first time in 1983, and it's become my second home. And I've been to Cuba between 1983 and last year. I've been to Cuba. I've lost really track how much I've been, but it's probably over like 30 times I've been. And then in 2019 alone, I went 3 times. And then in 2018, I was there for like 3 months. So I've been interested in Cuba as a social experiment of changing social relations, including race, since I first went there in 1983. I would say that between 1959 and 1962, there was a great deal of discussion on radio, on television, and newspapers and magazines and different organizations in Cuba. A great deal of discussion about race, the issue of race, anti-blackism, racial discrimination in that kind of 2 to 3 year period. But then there was a silence, basically, from 1962 to 1985 for literally like 23 years in which it was a non-topic. Now, people discussed it privately in their own homes, but there was nothing on radio, nothing on television, no newspaper articles, magazine articles, anything like that. There was a silence during this period. And we can discuss maybe some theories about why that was. And now it's a big topic once again, beginning in about the mid-'80s until the current period. So I sort of approach Cuba from a Pan-African point of view, in the sense that I'm concerned about what's happening with black people all over the world, whether it's in South Africa, whether it's in Zimbabwe, whether it's in Cuba. But Cuba is a particular interest to me because they had a serious revolution that we can talk about. And I'm concerned about what that revolution's impact has been upon black people. And that's been something that I've written about, I've read a lot about, and I would say also to people, and I'll bring up a couple books later, but there's been a literal explosion since the late 90s in terms of scholarship on the question of race and people. And most of the scholarship is done by scholars of color, you know, Afro-Caribbean scholars, African-American scholars, African scholars. So there's a lot of literature that's available now for people to really delve into and study.
Okay. Brother Otis, before we go any further, can you explain maybe to the people of why should Africans in America have an interest in terms of dealing with Cuba? Why should they have an interest in Cuba? Why is that important?
Yeah, I have a quote from jazz musician Whit Marcellus. He took his band from Lincoln Center there to Cuba for a week about maybe 12 years ago. And he was in a news conference, and one of the news persons asked him, well, why are you here? I mean, why would you come to Cuba? Why are you here? He said, I'm visiting my cousins. We all come from Africa, right? We have African descent. And the slave ship dropped us off in different places. Some people got dropped off in New Orleans. Some people got dropped off in Haiti. Some people got dropped off in Cuba or Charleston, South Carolina. But we're all cousins. And that's true. That's true. We have a similar experience because we are the descendants of slaves, the enslaved. So there's similarities and there are also differences in terms of how we've experienced slavery, how we've experienced so-called freedom. We speak different languages. The systems were not the same, but they're similar in certain kinds of ways. So I've always been interested in looking at the similarities and the differences, whether it be Haiti or whether it be Cuba. And Cuba is of a particular interest to me because of its relationship to Africa. It's a very international place. When you go to Cuba, you meet people from all over the world, especially from Africa. There's students there from Angola, Mozambique, the Congo. I mean, it's a very African kind of place. So I've always been interested in that. And also, you know, to look at what they've done around the struggle against racism. And they've done a lot. Well, I think they've done more than any other country in the world, though there's still work to be done. By that, I mean, for example, they instituted a comprehensive, free healthcare system in which healthcare does not cost in Cuba. Now, obviously, those at the bottom, and those were largely black and mulatto people, benefited by that reform. They instituted free education from preschool through university. So students in Cuba do not pay for books, they do not pay for classes, any of that. So that's a big reform that they did that benefited black and mulatto people. Also, they reduced rents by 50% very early in the revolution. And then, by law in Cuba, you cannot pay rent for more than 10 years. At the end of those 10 years, you either own the home you live in or the apartment. It belongs to you. It's not like in this country where you can pay rent your entire life and never own anything. So those are some really serious reforms. Then they instituted the system where you had full employment. So you didn't have unemployment. You didn't have homeless people. So those are big reforms that the revolution instituted. And in addition to that, that gave land to people who had no land. By that I mean peasants who worked on farms that were thousands of acres. They broke those big farms up and gave land to peasants so they could have their own land and do their own farming. So all of these reforms, including the literacy campaign, which they closed schools from basically 1960 to 1961, and people, young people went out to the countryside and taught people how to read and write because they had a literacy rate of about, I think it was about 45%. So within a year, they reduced that literacy rate to almost zero through this literacy campaign, where tens of thousands of young people went to the countryside and also in cities and taught people how to read and write, could not read and write. So these are big reforms which undermine in certain structural ways racism and anti-black feelings. But these are structural reforms that undermine racism in a structural way. But what was left undone largely was to attack racism as an ideological and a cultural question. By that I mean, what they did not do was to, for example, put in the school system at elementary, middle school, high school, or university level, like Afro-Cuban courses to talk about Afro-Cuban history, or courses that talk about what racism is, how it develops, how it's reproduced, you know, what forms it takes, that kind of thing. That they did not do. And so while they did some significant things, racism is still there. It has been reproduced. It exists largely in the private sphere, in people's families. You won't see necessarily public manifestations of it necessarily, but within families, if you study family structure, interracial dating, interracial marriage, that kind of thing, you see it manifest in certain kinds of ways. You also see it in public ways in the sense that you see, for example, it's very common. We used to talk about in the United States when we had mammy dolls, Aunt Jemima-looking dolls, where you have these caricatures of black people with big lips, big behinds, eating watermelon, you know, with grinning and all the rest of that. Those kind of things just exist in school today. That's unfortunate, and there's some pushback about that. And you do have in school today a very vibrant, I would say, anti-racist movement that is multi-generational, exists over the entire island, and is very active in various, cultural ways, pushing them back against the continuation of racist attitudes despite a revolution which is now 60 years old.
You know, Brother Otis, when we talk about race during any era or any time, it becomes a very, very complex issue to try to get a better grip on what we're really talking about. Based upon your experiences or interacting with the Cuban people, If you could just give us a sense of from your perspective, if you look at how Cuban people may have viewed race prior before 1959, and how they view the question of race today and racism today, what would you say would be the distinctions or the differences in terms of before 59 versus how the people in Cuba themselves see themselves today,
right,
as they deal with this question of race and racism?
Yeah, it's important to note that the largest number of enslaved Africans that came to the Western Hemisphere went to Brazil. Then the second largest number went to Cuba. And the third largest number went to the United States. Cuba had slavery, the period of slavery is longer than the U.S. because it started in about 1515, as opposed to the United States starting 1619, it went to 1888, which is literally almost 30 years longer than the United States. So it has a longer period of enslavement in Cuba. The the numbers of the enslaved of the total population were higher than in the United States. So from roughly 1600 to 1850, almost 1860, the majority of people in Cuba are Africans, right? Not like the United States, where you had a few southern states like Mississippi or South Carolina where the majority of population during the period of slavery was, in fact, Africans. But Cuba as a whole, for almost 260 years of this period of enslavement, the majority population was African, right? So that has a very important cultural and ideological impact in Cuba. Then from basically 1898 to 1959 with the revolution, you have a racist society in Cuba that is Jim Crow-like, similar to the United States, but not exactly the same. And so the revolution of 1959 is confronted with this long history of almost 400 years, including enslavement and the Jim Crow period that it has to confront. It has to confront this history in the context of this extreme pressure and hostility coming from the United States. So some people would argue that the reason why the anti-racist campaign was aborted in 1962, went from 1959 to 1962, was that the political leadership felt that they needed unity, complete unity, the most unity to resist the United States, military, economic pressure, political pressure from the United States. That's one argument. Another argument that people raise is, well, they naively thought, the leadership naively thought, that they could eliminate racism and racial discrimination in a short period of 2 to 3 years, even though it existed for more, almost 400 years. I would say that's naive at best. I mean, because you can't do that. You can't do that. It requires a prolonged struggle over years, year after year after year after year. I mean, you have to talk about it, you have to have public discourse, you got to be researching it, studying it, you know, over time. And so now, very recently, the government said in November of last year that this is a problem and continues to exist. We need a concerted effort to continue to fight on this terrain of against racism and racial discrimination. And so I'm looking forward to see what programs are going to be instituted to address this question. But as I said before, there are many organizations, non-governmental organizations in Cuba today that are led by Afro-Cubans and the Afro-Cuban Senate that are fighting around these questions. Doing education, popular education in the communities on these questions. And this has been going on since the mid-1980s. And one thing I would add to this important to note is that the rap and hip-hop community in Cuba are a serious component of this anti-racist struggle. It's reflected in their lyrics, their style. You have a huge burgeoning natural hair movement in Cuba, which is fairly new. So you have Black is Beautiful, Black Pride, natural hair movement, African clothes, you know, African names. A lot of stuff is happening in Cuba now that did not happen in the early 60s or 70s, and it's now just blowing up in the 90s. And so that's something which is quite encouraging, and hopefully the governmental movements around this question will include those folks who've been doing this work on the ground in Cuba for many, many years, and have been in the forefront of this kind of resurgent anti-racist movement. But I'd like to recommend a couple books to people that are really, really good. One book is called The Power of Race in Cuba, Racial Ideology and Black Consciousness During the Revolution. The author, her name is Danielle Cleland. The other book is Anti-Racism in Cuba, The Unfinished Revolution, by Devin Spence Benson. Both of these books are fairly new. The Cleland book, she's an Afro-Puerto Rican scholar at Florida International University in Miami. Devin Spence Benson is an African-American scholar who's at Davidson College in North Carolina. Both of these sisters are like, 40 years old. They were very quite young, and very accomplished. And both books are very well done. And anyone who chooses to read them, it'll be really eye opening because it's just stuff around race and people that you just never knew. And so they're brand new books. They're like a couple of years old, and I highly recommend these two people. It'll help you understand the similarities and the differences, because black people, even though we all come from Africa, we've experienced race and racism and slavery in different kinds of ways. It's not exactly the same, but but you can understand it if you seriously study Cuba, and you can understand the similarities and the differences and why the history is different and why it's similar in certain kinds of ways. And that's, from a comparative point of view, that's important to understand. So the fact that it's different does not mean it's unintelligible. You can understand both the similarities and the differences.
That's interesting. You made that point, brother, over this, because I was going to ask you if you could elaborate a little bit about the danger of bringing your own personal experiences of viewing things and using that as solely at the context of what you may see as Cuba. For example, some Cuban may will argue that to display physical features of African people with big lips and big butts and whatever is not necessarily a negative thing, but it's something that they're proud of. How would you deal with that perspective when the context of trying to include whether or not one is or isn't racist?
Yeah. This is something which is debated, because I know some Cubans, black Cubans, who don't see any problems with these caricatures, and I know other black Cubans who see it as a serious problem. This phenomena of these negative, of these stereotypical caricatures of black people is an international phenomenon. It's not just Cuba, or it's not just the United States. And so, for example, I know one Cuban cultural figure who's a writer who told me she went to a meeting of Afro-descendant people in Colombia, South America. She said that she went to the meeting, and there were people there from all over Central America, Mexico, and South America, Afro-descendants. And she said she went as a Cuban, and she returned as an Afro-descendant. So I said, well, what do you mean? What does that mean? She says, well, oftentimes people in Cuba will say to us, black Cubans, well, Cuba is unique. It's really different. It's not like other countries. So she said when she went to the meeting and they were discussing, anti-black attitudes, racial discrimination, racism, and racist caricatures of black people, she could see that some of the jokes, some of these dials and whatnot, you can find them all over Latin America, right? That this is something which has been universalized. So she also said, too, that what that meant to her was that one thing which is common all over Latin America is that white Latin Americans could be white under colonialism, and when colonialism was overthrown and you had republics, they could still be white. Black people this is what the sister said to me. Black people, in order to enter the new nation, the new republic, after the end of colonialism, they're supposed to give up their distinctiveness, their differentness, their different history, right? That's what they're supposed to do. White people are not required. Now, white people are not required to do that. Not required to do that. In other words, if you want to enter the modern nation, you have to cease to be black, to make distinctions, to have differences, that kind of thing. And so she said that when she went to that meeting, she came back to understanding this question of race in a more comprehensive and a deeper way, the similarities and differences that she had with other Afro descendants within the Western Hemisphere. You know, that's an important distinction. So I don't impose my view of race on Cubans. I study their experience. I talk to them about their experience. And I understand the similarities and the differences and why we have these similarities and differences, because we haven't all experienced race in the same kind of way. So it's not, it doesn't make sense to impose these views, but to understand the differences. Just like in South Africa, you know, they have not experienced race in exactly the same way we have. And black people, no black person should think that the experience of other people of African descent in the world is exactly the same as yours. So if you have that view, it's incorrect. You know, and you should study specifically the experiences of people in other places in the world of African descent and understand their similarities and differences and their reasons why that exists.
You know, Brother Onis, if I heard you correctly in your earlier presentation, you mentioned about maybe the weakness in terms of dealing with the issue of race and racism from an ideological perspective.
Right.
I would like for you to articulate from your perspective how has the impact of race and racism are dealt with or viewed in the context of a socialist society versus in a capitalist society. So we don't make these mistakes of not properly looking at the essence of what we're dealing with. Give me your perspective. How socialism have impacted around this struggle dealing with this concept of race and racism inside of Cuba and your perspective outside when it comes to a capitalist society?
Right. Well, you know, racism has both structural and cultural aspects to it. In other words, for example, if we were looking at racial disparities in the United States or even in Cuba, we would look at such things as education. We would look at housing. We would look at employment. Those are the kinds of things we would look at, right? But racism is just not a question of housing, education, employment, right? It is an ideological question. It is a system of ideas and thoughts and feelings, right? So therefore, when Cuba dealt with these structural questions, which are important to level the playing field around these structural questions, there's still these ideological and cultural questions about people being feeling superior or inferior, right? Straight hair is better than kinky hair, light skin or white skin is superior to black skin, thin lips are superior to more full lips, you know, this kind of thing. Or blacks are lazy or they're not as intelligent. These are questions that also have to be addressed within the educational system, within film or television or radio or magazines or newspapers on an ongoing basis. So some people say, well, you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union and this real economic decline that happened in the 90s, racism returned, okay, to Cuba, and it had been eradicated. More seasoned scholars say, no, it never went away, right? You know, it kind of like went underground, so to speak, but it never went away. So you're talking about a resurgence, a resurgence of racism. So I'm simply saying that it's not just, and I think to some degree, Cubans, and this is a critique that I have, when you look at the kind of speeches in 1959, 1960, 1961 by Cuban leadership, they talk about racism in a kind of economic way, right? You know, so racism can be solved by opening up recreation areas, equalizing education, equalizing housing. And I'm saying all of those are important. That's part of it, but that's not the only thing. You know, it can continue to live within individuals, within families, within at work sites and the like, and reproduce itself. You know, racism is reproduced over and over again. People are not born racist. They learn that. You know, they learn it in their families. They learn it within their friends, in their social connections, at the workplace, and the like. So you have to be looking at that, arguing about it, monitoring it, studying it, and all the rest of this. You know, they made a lot of progress. They made a lot of progress, but there's still work to be done. We might say we made some progress here on the Capitol, but there's a lot more to be done. But without a doubt, Cuba has done more than we've done in the United States. I mean, there's light years of difference, but still, there's a lot of work. There's a lot of work to be done. But it's light years different than that. So, for example, when I'm in Cuba, and it doesn't matter what town or city I'm in, I can go out 24/7 and just walk in any direction because I feel perfectly safe, right? But I wouldn't do that in Chicago or New York or Richmond, Virginia, where you're at, or whatever. You know, you just wouldn't do that because it's not safe to do that. But there's a great deal of safety, a great deal of security. I just give you an example. When I was there for 3 months, I noticed that middle school students have an extended lunch break. So they eat in school, and then they walk around the neighborhood every day for like about an hour, hour and a half before they go back to school. That doesn't happen in the United States. But those children and their parents feel safe. So they walk around the neighborhood, they're sitting in the park eating candy, they go and get some ice cream at the ice cream store and walk around and then go back to school. I saw that every day. So that was an indication to me of a level of security that they and their parents felt for their children. And you saw young people out in public parks, you know, university students, 11, 12, 1 o'clock at night, you know, talking to each other, listening to the radio, playing music. And I rarely saw a policeman, a police car, you know. I mean, you just didn't see it. So how do you have this level of security that people feel without a so-called police state? I mean, so basically, you know, Chicago is more like a police state than Havana is. I mean, you see more police in Chicago than you see in Havana, you know, even though they're about basically the same in terms of population. But this is very different. It's very different.
All right, Brother Otis, what we're going to do right now, we're going to take a station break. And when we come back, we will open up our phone lines for our listening audience.
Okay.
If you have any views or comments, as we continue to discuss this important issue of race in Cuba, getting an understanding with our Brother Otis today. Please feel free to call in at 818-337-0016. We're going to pause for the station break, and we'll be right back. You are listening to MPH Radio.
One, two, one, two, three, four.
Moving up, but it's okay.
And I bought a 2 for 2, both for me, and I'll set you free.
Rap on, brother, rap on.
Well, the only person talking about love, man, brother, is the preacher. And it seems nobody gets to study and learn it but the teacher.
Most Cubans
continued to live in the same housing that they lived in 1959, right? Okay. So there's some people who had fairly good housing in 1959, and it hasn't deteriorated that much, and it's still in pretty good shape. But the other people who lived in dilapidated housing in 1959, it has continued to deteriorate. But because of the material limitations of the country, in other words, Cuba is a poor, undeveloped, developing country. It doesn't have oil. It doesn't have natural gas. It doesn't have coal, right? So it has, like, fruit and vegetables and things like that. But certain kinds of things that you need for industrial development, it does not have. Like I said, coal, natural gas, oil, for example. It doesn't have that. So they have built a lot of new houses, especially in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. But they weren't able to replace all the housing they needed to replace because they don't have certain resources in order to do that, both in terms of money and materials. So some people are stuck in the housing that needs to be rehabbed or totally torn down and need new housing, right? So you do see a disparity in terms of housing. And that's not the policy of the government. It's their inability because of the lack of resources to make all the housing the quality that it ought to be. So disproportionately, if you move around Havana, for example, the areas of Havana like Verdado, New Verdado, Minimar, places like that that have better housing. If you go to Central Havana or you go to Old Havana, you'll see more sort of dilapidated housing. And you also will notice that the concentration in terms of racial demography of Central Havana or Old Havana is like blacker, right? Because these are people who lived in this housing, who now have this housing, their parents lived in this housing, their grandparents lived in this housing, and they've never been able to either rehab their housing or get new housing. On the other hand, if you go east of Havana, outside of Havana, you will see new neighborhoods that were built in the 60s and the 70s and 80s to relieve overcrowding and allow people, at least to some degree, allow some folks to be able to leave dilapidated housing in Central and Old Havana and move to these kind of suburbs. And they have public transportation. And this housing is newer. It's in better shape. It was built in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But they're not able to do that for everyone. So you do see this housing disparity, which is a historic situation, which they haven't been able to completely eliminate. They've done a lot, but not completely eliminated totally. So you do see that.
Okay, let's open up that phone lines for those waiting to comment or have a question. Then we have subject matter today. Please call in at 818-337-0016, and please hit 1, and we will acknowledge your last 4 numbers. Please hit 1 if you have a comment or question. So right now we can go to our first caller, Otis. Caller number 6057, caller 6057. Your question or comment, please.
Certainly. Thanks for having me. And thanks for your presentation, Brother Otis. It was very informative. A couple of observations and then a question. Cuba, from my research, was one of the last countries in the Western Hemisphere to abolish chattel slavery. And one big difference between with slavery in Cuba and the U.S., in addition to the duration, is the fact that that the U.S. Was a predominantly European settler colony, whereas Cuba has been predominantly African since the incursion of the colonization by the Spanish back in the 1500s. And let's see, and my question to you, to what degree has the blockade impeded Cuba's ability to attack, to deal with the ideological aspects of racism, considering the fact that Cuba's been at war with the U.S. for nearly 60 years since the advent of its revolution.
Thank you, Carlo.
Yeah, well, some people argue that the reason why the anti-racist campaign, which began in 1959 and went to 1962 roughly and was aborted at that point, where it stopped, was because of the blockade and the economic and political and military pressure on the Cuban Revolution. And some people would argue that the political leadership decided to abort this campaign so as to promote unity in the Cuban population between mulattoes and whites and blacks. Some people argue that, well, they don't agree with that assessment if that was the case, because they feel like that's a false unity. You can have an anti-racist struggle and promote unity at the same time. And it's instructive to note that, for example, the Cuban Revolution did set up certain organizations. It set up a Central Trade Union Federation to continue to promote unity of workers. It set up a Cuban Federation of Women, which was a multiracial organization around women's equality, women's rights. They set up a youth organization, different ones for different levels of students. But they did not set up an ongoing anti-racist organization. And by that I mean, I'm not talking about an all-black organization, but to have an anti-racist organization, which is multiracial, and will continue to fight around racism, it will continue to study, it will continue to propagate ideas around race, what race is, what it isn't, what racism is, what anti-discrimination is. They did not do that. They did not do that. And so what you have on the ground now in Cuba is you have the formation of non-governmental organizations throughout the island that are doing this kind of work. So we'll see what's going to happen with the government's acknowledgement, open acknowledgement last November, that the racism is a continuing problem and it must be fought. We'll see what sort of programs will be propagated. So that's sort of what I think about that.
Okay, we're going to take our next caller, caller 2714. 2714, welcome to MPH Radio.
Thank you. Brother Otis, I just want to say that it was a great presentation. My name is Brother Maurice. I just had one, want to just clarify something. When we talk about the ideological experiences with racism, is it safe to say that it's more of biases than racism? Because from my interpretation, racism is a system that is that is enforced by government, and in a sense of Cuba, Fidel Castro, he once proclaimed himself being of African. He's an African. We came from Africans, and all of the work they did with producing a lot of sisters, African sisters who are in the medical health field, and also with giving a new home to political prisoners, and all the work that they're doing in Africa, have done in Africa, and have done around the world. That being said, and plus, last but not least, you don't hear about, I don't want to sound like I'm romanticizing Cuba, but I just want to point out those realities, because, I don't hear about too many police attacks in Cuba, or police, too much police killings in Cuba on African people, such as the United States of America. I don't hear about, Ku Klux Klan or Cuba Klan, if you will, attacking or murdering African people in Cuba. So I just want to see if is it safe to say that it's more of a bias with, when you talk about the skin color and the hair type and the nose. Is
right,
it more of a
right.
bias than racism? Thanks.
Well, yeah, let me give you an example of how it functions in some ways. For example, I listened to a lecture by a professor on Cuba recently, and she said that of the private restaurants, right? You know, you have private restaurants in Cuba now. That of the 600, I think it was like 675 private restaurants in Havana, that five of the restaurants was black owned, right? Okay. Now that doesn't surprise me. But also what you see in Havana is you rarely, when you go to a private restaurant, you rarely see any black people waiting tables. You rarely see any black bartenders, right? Now I don't know who's in the kitchen. What I'm saying is, it is very common to go in these restaurants and see all white kids, one restaurant after another. Now, black Cubans complain about this all the time, my friends and mine, that I know, right? Now, obviously, the money that comes to set up these restaurants probably comes from Miami and outside of Cuba, right? So I'm not saying that the Cuban government can't control who is able to set up a private restaurant, either building a building from the ground up, I've seen that, or using your house, because you got a fairly nice house, and you got a yard, and you can have a restaurant. The Cuban government probably cannot control that, but they can control who's employed. And black Cubans are complaining about the fact that these restaurants are almost lily white, right? Now, I had a meeting a few years ago, myself and another group of people, we had a meeting at the Central Confederation of Trade Unions with the International Relations Department, and I brought that question up. And so what my group was told, well, look, everybody who works in a restaurant has to go through a training program and an internship, and that is maintained by the Central Trade Union. The internship and the training, we have a hiring list. And the owner or the manager of these different restaurants have to interview and select from that list. Okay, fine. That's probably accurate. But if the demography of who's employed in these restaurants are not reflective of the demography of that list and the state licenses those restaurants, they should tell them, if you discriminate, we're going to shut you down. We're going to shut you down. Okay? Because there's a lot of dissatisfaction about hiring practices in these restaurants. There are even commercials on Cuban TV that talk about that the main characteristic of who you hire should not be their race. But you go in these restaurants, you rarely see anybody black working in there. Now, they may be cleaning up, or they may be in their kitchen, but they definitely ain't waiting tables, and they're not the bartenders. And it's very common. It's rare to see anybody black. So it can take that form. So maybe people are employing their friends, their family members, and the like. But there's a lot of tension around this on the ground amongst, you know, Afro-Cubans. And so that I think can be a state intervention. And then, like I say again, they probably can't control the money that comes in from Miami for family members to be able to set up these restaurants, right? But they can control who's hired. And that's one of the forms that just racism takes.
Okay, let's go to that next caller. Next caller will be caller 6029. Welcome to MPH Radio. Your comment or question, 6029.
Yes, sir. Let me just ask the brother, to his knowledge, does he know of any Africans, say, in America who are investing in Cubans to ensure that they have the opportunity to actually open a restaurant for themselves?
No, I don't know of any. I don't know. I know there are black folks in Cuba who support Cubans in different kinds of ways. Whether it's, you know, like, for example, when I go to Cuba, I always, you know, bring books to people because I know they may either can't afford them or they don't have access. and so I share things. Like, for example, I was supposed to go to Cuba in March. And, of course, I had, because of the COVID, I couldn't go. But I had met some young Cuban activists in December when I was there who were part of this natural hair movement. And so they sent me a list of products that they needed to do hair and to do exhibitions and the like. And so my wife and I, we went to the supply store and bought a lot of the stuff and then couldn't take it, right, in March when we were supposed to go. But whenever we get through this COVID, I will do that. So, you know, I do that and other people do things like that to support. Except, see, the other issue is that, you know, most Cubans who are in the United States, Miami, you know, I think 85% of them consider themselves as white Cubans. So in other words, there are not that many black Cubans in the United States, Spain, or other places that have resources to send back to, you know, their Afro-Cuban relatives in order to set up restaurants and businesses of different kinds. So, and obviously that's largely because, you know, the reason why Miami demographically may be 85% white Cuban, but the island doesn't look like that, is because the majority of people who elected to immigrate, especially during the early period of the 1960s and 70s, they were mostly white Cubans who ran away from the revolution. And it wasn't just that the revolution was socialist. I think that there was some profound changes around race in Cuba, such as the elimination of private schools. You had to go to school in a public school in an integrated setting. There are a lot of reasons why these white Cubans left and went to Miami and other places. And so the percentages of Afro-Cubans in the United States and other places around the world is very low. So, and they say that, you know, maybe 70%, 75% of the remittances are funds that Cubans outside of Cuba send back to family members, like largely through the Western Union, or they, when they physically come and visit, they bring money. But most of those remittances are going and being sent by white Cubans outside of Cuba to white Cubans in Cuba. And black Cubans get maybe 15% of the remittances, and that's about it. So that makes a whole lot of social difference, too. You know, who has money and who don't have money based on money being sent from outside of the country to in the country. And, of course, there's a zillion Western Union offices all over that. I mean, a zillion of them. And I speak, for example, if a person were to get $100 a month, just $100 a month, or even $100 a month, they wouldn't even have to work, right? If you got $100 a month in Western Union, you wouldn't even have to work, you know, because food is cheap, rent is cheap, you know. And so, you know, that's a social problem too, see, because remittances create, you know, class cleavages, racial cleavages, this kind of thing. And I'm not blaming that on the government. You know, I'm just saying the practical implication of that is these cleavages that exist, that you see on the ground in terms of how people are dressed, you know, people who got cars, people who ain't got no cars, you know, it's just an issue.
Okay, let's go to our next caller. We're going to bring in caller 9435. You can bring in caller 9435. Welcome to MPH Radio. Your question or comment, caller 9435. Once, going twice, caller 9435. Would you like to make a question, have a question or comment? Okay, let's continue the discussion. Brother Otis, the last caller raised a real interesting point when we talk about the influx of money coming from the outside inside, and which historically has always gone to those communities that many would call European communities. Now, for Africans, we raised the question, why should they care about Cuba? What kind of ways can those Africans who hear this program, or Africans outside of Cuba, what kind of ways can they play to improve the situation internally among Africans, but more importantly, though, improve the general consideration given Cuba as a whole? Because we understand the fundamental issues. Our biggest contribution we can make is organize ourselves to get rid of this blockade against Cuba. Because Cuba can take out their own people if they have many of these limitations on the outside. So your response to how can those play a role in terms of who may want to help brothers and sisters inside of Cuba? What would be your ideal suggestions or ways of making a contribution to that phenomenon?
Yeah, I think primary commitment and contribution would be to change U.S. policy against Cuba, to remove the blockade and all other economic obstacles, to return the Guantanamo naval base to Cuba, to respect Cuban sovereignty. And, you know, there's a movement, for example, that's afoot now to get different cities and towns in the U.S. to pass resolutions opposing the embargo and the blockade. So, for example, in Chicago, where I am, I'm part of a group that's working on getting a city council resolution passed. I know in New York, a resolution has been introduced. I think one in D.C. Yeah, different cities. So there are probably about a dozen cities. Detroit, I know, has passed a resolution opposing the U.S. blockade and demanding normal relations between the U.S. and Cuba. And there are other cities around the country that are doing this kind of work. And, you know, we've, at least in Chicago, we've seen some receptivity by different aldermen in support of this. It sort of got held up because of the COVID. So everything kind of like on hold, but that's something that people could do in their different cities, to try to get the cities or towns to pass resolutions opposing the blockade. Now, obviously, the Congress will have to do that. It can't be done by cities, but you can try to build support and do some educational work so folks understand, you know, what's at stake. Because the other thing that it's important to note that these sort of sanctions against countries are almost all of the sanctions against countries in the world are countries of color, right? I mean, literally, you know, whether you're talking about Venezuela, you're talking about Iran, you're talking about Cuba, you know, all of these sanctions that are applied by the United States, sanctions and blockades and embargoes against countries of color in the world. And basically what it is that if you do not agree to do the U.S. bidding, that is to allow the U.S. to exploit your natural resources or exploit labor in your country, then you're the enemy. And you're going to be strangled, right? Because what I argue is that, you know, people make revolutions to make their lives better, the quality of life better. That's the reason why they want change and they make revolutions, right? So the U.S. position is, if you dare to do that, we will strangle you. We will strangle you, right? And we will do that in order to convince people that they can't make a change. They can't have a revolution, right? You have to go along with what the U.S. says. Otherwise, we will punish you. We will strangle you. And that's what the U.S. is doing, not only in Cuba, but a lot of countries around the world. And all of them are countries of color. Every single one.
Okay, Brother Otis, what we're going to do right now, we're going to pause for the station break. And when we come back, we would like for you to give us some final thoughts on the subject of race in Cuba, getting a better understanding. And we definitely would like for you to talk just a little bit about Cuba, its relationship to Africa, and the good things that the Cuban people are doing for the world. So we're going to pause for this call, and we'll be right back. You are listening to MPH Radio.
one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you loved your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you held your white teacher?
Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
would make a better society. And if you had a choice of
color, which one would you choose, my brother? Welcome back to MPH Radio. We're in our closing segment as we discuss this phenomenon of race in Cuba, getting a better understanding with our brother Otis Cunningham. Brother Otis, can you quickly respond to the issue of first, what does it say about Cuba where every year you get over 99% of the world countries voting against the U.S. blockade against Cuba?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think just last year when they voted, it was like three countries that supported the U.S. Well, it was U.S., Israel, and I think the Ukraine or something like that. It was three. So it was like 190-some countries opposing U.S. position, and only three countries, including the U.S., that supported that position. But I would also say, too, that, you know, Cuba solidarity with the world, especially the developing world, is important. And you see it now with COVID. You know, they've dispatched medical teams to Angola, to the Congo, to South Africa, for example, to Jamaica, St. Kitts, Trinidad, all over the Caribbean. They've dispatched medical brigades to fight this COVID-19. They've sent some to Europe, but primarily to the Caribbean and to Africa. But this is a continuation of what they've been doing for a long time. There's thousands of African students who studied engineering in Cuba, who studied medicine in Cuba, nursing in Cuba, veterinary medicine in Cuba. So when you go to Cuba, I mean, one place is very black in terms of even Cubans themselves, but when you go there, it's a very international city, and you meet Africans from all over the continent. There are students there, and most of them are on scholarship. They're not paying for their education or anything like that. They're mostly on scholarship. And I've seen them in hospitals, you know, because I had a little medical problem when I was there for like 3 months, so I had to go to this clinic. And when I went in, there was all these Congolese students, medical students, that I saw in the clinic when I would go to the clinic. And so it's a very, like I say, international place. And they have thousands of doctors all over the world, mostly in the developing world, working in Venezuela or places like that in South Africa. And then they have this medical school. It's called ELA, the Latin American Medical School, which I think is about 15,000 students from all over the world. They're there. that are there, including some students from the United States. So it's a phenomenal school because you just think everybody who goes to that school learns in Spanish, right? So there's some folks from Latin America who already speak Spanish, but other students who don't speak Spanish have to take 1 year of Spanish before they start taking the medical classes. But you can imagine what it's like to be, let's say, an American student in that school. We are going to school with people from South Africa, from Angola, from Mozambique, from Venezuela, just all over, 15,000 students. But that's a policy that's existed since the 1960s, so it's not anything new. And that's part of the reason why I think that the U.S. position on Cuba is so isolated, because Cuba has so many friends around the world because of their diplomacy. You know, they have friends not because they have military might. They have friends because they help other countries with whatever their meager resources happen to be. Because they have human capital. They don't have, you know, really money to give out to other countries or, you know, help them in a financial way, but they have human power, and they do that with their medical brigades or giving scholarships to students from the third world to come to Cuba and go to school. So that's something that's been around since the 1960s. It's very important, and Cuba is very proud of that. Very proud of that. So I have a lot of friends because, you know, before I retired, I was in the medical field, but I have a lot of friends in Cuba who are doctors, either current doctors or they're retired doctors, and almost all of them have served overseas, you know, because the family I stay with when I go, she's a retired doctor. She was in Tanzania. I've met other doctors who were in South Africa or in Angola, you know. So that's very common to experience. And so Cubans are kind of isolated from the United States, but they're not isolated in the world. That's important. That's because of their policy and their outlook. So I encourage people, at least when this COVID stuff is over, to go to Cuba, experience Cuba. And at least for me, it was transformative since 1983 when I first went. My sort of kind of outlook and sensibility, political sensibility is very different, because it's one thing to imagine something which is better. It's another thing to actually see it. Another way it's possible. It ought to be possible for young middle school students to walk around in the street, you know, during the day and not be afraid. So it is possible. It is possible. We live in the richest country in the world, but we don't have free health care. We don't have free education, right? But that's possible. So when people see it, they say, well, you know, they have limited resources. They can do this, they can do that, they can do that. Why can't we do it, right? It poses, I think it's by the very example, it poses those kinds of questions, which are important, you know, which are important. In terms of even transforming your own society, you know, so we should support them, but also looking at what they are doing should make people wonder, why can't we do that? You know.
And Brother Otis, for brothers and sisters who've never been to Cuba, who may have a backward perception of Cuba, just briefly talk a little bit about the kind of love and the welcome that you would get from the Cuban people. What the Cuban people are like. We recognize that they are very conscious in terms of being able to make the distinction between the people in the U.S. and the government in the U.S. Can you just talk about this whole humanity of love that you receive from the Cuban people when you are there in their presence?
Yeah, Cubans are very relaxed. They are very friendly, very open, and very caring. I mean, so when I'm in Cuba, I feel very comfortable. I feel like I'm at home. And actually, I have a sense of relief, you know, because, you know, I'm not worried about being racially profiled
you know, I'm not worried about getting robbed, getting mugged. I mean, I just feel very comfortable. Like I said, you know, in Cuba, no matter what city I'm in, no matter what time of the day it is, I'll just go out and walk in any direction. And I have no fear at all, you know. So it's just like really, really, it's really, really different in that kind of way. So you have a sense of security. And also, you know, I've met a lot of American college students because they have a lot of study abroad programs. And I know they're not going to happen this fall because of the COVID, but when I was there for 3 months in 2018, I met a lot of American college students, you know, different races of students. But, and they all marveled at the fact that they could move around Havana in a way that they can't move around their home cities in the U.S. where they go to school. So they had a sense of joy and a sense of relief and a sense of security that they just did not have. An example of that, there was a young brother who is from Chicago, and he was a family friend, and he did a study abroad program in Havana in 2018. We were there for like 3 months. I remember him hanging out with us one day, and we went to lunch, and he needed to go back to school, right? And we were in a different neighborhood. And I said, well, you got money for the bus? He said, yeah, right. And then he just got on the bus and went back to school, right? For example, if he had come over to my house in Chicago and he needed to go back home, I probably would drive him home. I wouldn't just say, okay, just get on the bus. Why? Because it ain't safe. You know, so it's very different. We didn't feel concerned about him in a different neighborhood in Havana, making his way back to the University of Havana where he was going to school. He didn't feel uncomfortable. We didn't feel uncomfortable because we knew he was safe, and he knew it. You know, so it's a different. It's just a completely different. It's just a completely different feel there than it is here. And it's when you move around, just walking around the streets, it's so obvious. You know, it's so obvious that it's real. It's just real different. I'm not saying it's perfect, you know, but it's just real different. And I feel very comfortable there. Like I say, it's my second home.
Brother Otis, in 2 to 3 minutes, just give us your final summation on the theme today, racing Cuba, getting an understanding. Your final thoughts.
Right. I think people should, study race in Cuba. I think it's important to understand their social experiment. It also helps to, it seems to me, it helps you to even understand your own experience in the United States. So, for example, as an anti-apartheid activist, I studied South Africa, right, in the anti-apartheid movement. But it wasn't just studying the anti-apartheid movement or studying race in Cuba about those experiences, but it helped me to understand my own experience within the United States, because you look through different lens, you know. It's a different way of looking at things, and that helps you to even understand your own experience. So it's not just learning the experience of others, but even in doing so, it helps you understand your own experience. And I would lastly say that I think we have a special responsibility around U.S. foreign policy, just as we did with the anti-apartheid movement, right? Our responsibility was largely to make sanctions against apartheid, change U.S. policy towards the apartheid regime, because the U.S. was helping to oppress folks in South Africa. The same is true in Cuba. Our responsibility is to change U.S. policy and respect Cuban sovereignty. They have a right to self-determination. The U.S. has no right to possess that base. They have no right to apply sanctions or an embargo on Cuba. And that is our responsibility to get rid of that.
And on that note, Brother Otis Cunningham, we would like to thank you for sharing your experiences and your expertise as it relates to the theme today, race in Cuba, getting an understanding. And if you have any new development that comes about, we would like for you to feel free to come back. Because one of the things we want to do at Missing Pages of History Radio is that we want to fill in those missing pages of our history that has been omitted. and greatly to history and the contribution of Cuba definitely fall in that category. So, again, we thank you for being able to fill in one of our missing pages of history today. We thank you.
Yes, thanks for having me.
All right, listen, audience, you listen to MPH Radio. We're going to close on out. We would just like to remind you that MPH Radio is a division of the Missing Pages of History. For those who listen to this program and those who want to support this program, you can always feel free to make your contribution to MPH Radio by sending it to Missing Pages of History, P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. Right now, because the pandemic that's going on, activities have been canceled. But if you'd like to know about more about our goals, dreams, and objectives, please visit our website at www.mphinc.org. We have an open mission. We're recruiting new people to come help build this institution so we can better serve our communities as well as humanity. Come help us build these institutions. We need your help and your support. So until next time, this is a bi-weekly program. We'll see you in 2 weeks. And just remember, this battle of creating a better humanity for all people is a responsibility of not only for you, not only for your family, but it's a responsibility for all conscious human beings who are living today. We'd like to thank you for allowing us to come to your home this evening. And we are on the front line. We must continue to fight. And if we fight in the sense of being organized, that's one thing we can learn from the Cuba experience, is if you are organized, all things are possible. So we encourage our people to get organized, to build an organization that is doing something to help your people and all humanity. Until next time, let's continue to move forward. Remember that we are on the front line. We'll see you in 2 weeks.